Shrink Wrap Radio number 543, Trauma Therapy with Dr. Guy McPherson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Oakland, California-based psychologist Guy McPherson, Ph.D., about his work in trauma therapy. For more information about Dr. Guy McPherson, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Guy McPherson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Dave, so much for having me. It's truly an honor to be here.
Oh, well, that's great. That's great. Does that mean you've listened to the show?
That means I've definitely listened to the show, and just really in awe of the amount of material you've put out, the depth and breadth of what you're doing here. And for someone like myself, as a young podcaster, I really admire and look up to what you're doing. So,
well, thank you very much, and I'm feeling the full weight of that because I'm trying to create an archive of all of the work, and it means I've got to type up a whole bunch of stuff for, at this point, you're number 543.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I'm glad to have you on the show. Now, you specialize in adolescent trauma and early psychosis therapy. Maybe you can tell us how you got into that work and what your background is and all.
Well, yeah. I mean, I started off actually writing fiction, and I was writing fiction probably about 20 years ago. And about 3 years into that, when I was finishing a second book that hadn't been published, I got a call from a friend of mine whom I hadn't seen in about couple of years. We had worked in a restaurant in San Francisco together. Actually, at the time I was living in Los Angeles. And she, it turned out, was calling each of her friends to tell them that she had AIDS. She had had it for about 10 years. Mm. And basically this was a call. She was saying goodbye.
Wow.
And at that time I had been writing about courage and persistence and resilience. And here was this woman who was living it. And when I got off the phone with her, I felt, a myriad of emotions, but one of them was this emptiness in the pit of my stomach. Like, there's no way I felt that I could have that courage to deal with and to confront what she was going through. And that kind of set me on a trajectory to, like, I need to find something. There was something missing for me, and it had to do with helping other people.
Uh-huh.
So I went back to school. I got my BA. I was actually I was determined to become a physician. And that certainly wasn't my strength. But what happened was I was actually helping my classmates manage the stress of this whole process. And people would say to me, "Are you sure you want to do this? Have you thought about like becoming a therapist and stuff like that?" And I was like, no. So that was kind of...
Well, what age were you when you went back to school?
I was 36. That 36.
36. So you were what we call a returning student
A non-traditional student, a returning student.
And in my experience, you people, do very well in school because when you come in at that age, you're motivated. You're ready to buckle down. You've sort of sown a lot of your wild oats by then.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I knew that I wanted to be involved with trauma. I knew I wanted to be involved with helping people in really dire situations and circumstances. And that how that unfolded is kind of part two to that question, but that's kind of initially how I got into the field.
Yeah. What's the part two that you questioned? Well, it got me intrigued there.
Yeah. The part two was that I applied for PhD programs in clinical psychology, and I was going through the process. Again, knew I wanted to study trauma. And when I was doing my postdoc, I was riding along in my car. I was like commuting for literally an hour and a half each way, and always thinking to myself, you know, what did I do with my clients? I didn't do the right thing. I should have done this. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't think I was helping at all. And I was simultaneously listening to podcasts. And these podcasts were of these entrepreneurs kind of, you know, doing amazing things with their lives. And in these interviews, I was like thinking to myself, well, maybe I could interview like seasoned trauma therapists. And wouldn't it be great if I could have like a mentor sitting right beside me in the car? Hmm. And I was like, that was it. And I was like, that's what I want to do. So I started founded the Trauma Therapist Project, which is essentially kind of my umbrella company. And then about a year later, started the podcast and started interviewing. Initially, I just wanted to interview like seasoned trauma therapists, but that, not surprisingly, kind of has blossomed and bloomed into other areas, other specialties, modalities, yoga. You know, I interview a lot of yogis. I interview a lot of people from the military, people who are in the military and are now working with other veterans, or therapists who work exclusively with veterans and so forth, mindfulness. So it's been just an incredible learning experience for me. And I bet doing what you do for so long has been a learning experience for you too.
Yeah, it definitely has been. So are you still working as a therapist or strictly as a podcaster?
Doing both. I work in a clinic, county clinic, that specializes in treating and assessing kids who are showing early signs of psychosis. And not surprisingly, 90% of those kids have trauma. Come from varying traumatic backgrounds, early quote unquote early psychosis or clinical high risk is really a quote unquote new field within the last 10 years. It's an emerging field.
Oh, really? Tell me a little bit more about that, because I'm surprised to hear that.
Right. Well, traditionally, it was thought that, well, you either had psychosis or you didn't. You either had schizophrenia or you didn't. In a sense, it was like kind of just, we're just going to wait and see. But what they found out, and initially this started in Australia and then in Europe, they found out that individuals who were diagnosed with schizophrenia, they were able to go back and determine that there was a duration of untreated psychosis, which usually went on for about 2 years. And during that time, or actually starting that time, there were signs, there were symptoms. There were, that category actually is called the prodrome or prodromal symptoms, or clinical high risk, we call it. Seeing shadows, maybe having unusual thought content, maybe experiencing or exhibiting suspiciousness or paranoia. Now, the thing here is that there's still insight. In other words, you know, I see, I might think I'm having a visual hallucination, but I know it's not quote unquote real. I understand that it's my imagination.
So you're saying if you catch them early enough in the process, they're easier to talk to and they can have insight.
And there's a much better chance of preventing something more serious from happening. And that could be major depression with psychotic features. On the far end of the continuum, that would be schizophrenia. So definitely if we're able to catch them in that zone, in that clinical high-risk zone, they have a very good chance of not going on to be have more serious symptoms.
That's fascinating. And geez, this is my 543rd interview, not counting Wise Counsel, which was about 126. And I've never heard that before. One of the things that you said that did ring a bell for me was when I was a graduate student, and I remember reading about psychosis and so on, and working in a mental hospital for a while, that there was always a background of trauma. When you looked at the charts,
it
didn't really come from nowhere. Somehow it was presented like, oh, this kind of came from nowhere. But when you look closely, you often found just very, very difficult early childhood.
You hit it on the head, Dr. Dave. I mean, that's exactly it. And that's, pardon me, one of the jobs that we do is to take these phone screens. And I love taking phone screens from teachers or parents, or sometimes clients themselves. And there's always this picture, and it's a puzzle. And again, just like you said, this does not come from nowhere. And most of the time, it comes from trauma. And after getting all these calls, doing all these phone screens, I was thinking to myself, what the heck is going on here? And a large part of my initiative has really been as a response to that. I didn't get into to situation with my brother also, but a lot of it is, how is this going on? You know, so in a large part, my goal with the Trauma Therapist Project is to really help bring the awareness to trauma, what the heck is going on, and to help other therapists get into this field.
Yeah. Now, you know, as a clinically trained person, I'm listening to everything you say. So what's this about your brother? Is that something that sounds like it might be relevant here?
Well, my brother was in the Special Forces. He was a Navy SEAL. And when he came back from Iraq, now probably 15 years ago, he came back with PTSD. Mm-hmm. And this was before I knew anything about this. He came back and he was extremely symptomatic, and I didn't know what was going on. And I was so excited to talk to him, to find out what went on. What did he do? I wanted details. And I kept pressuring him. I kept bugging him. I kept nagging him. And I've told this story before, and I'm embarrassed saying this because it's exactly what you shouldn't do, but it's exactly what I did. I didn't know what he was going through. And I wanted to come back, and I wanted to fix that in a sense. I wanted to help that in a sense, you know. It was
I could see where PTSD would be particularly difficult for him, because I think I have an image, and I suspect most of us have an image of Navy SEALs as iron men, right? They are impenetrable and can go through anything. So, but what you're suggesting, you know, and we know as psychologists that that's kind of a dangerous psychologically, that can be a precarious self-image.
Exactly. And it's so true. It's one of the reasons why it's almost a cliche. I mean, these guys don't get help. They don't even want to admit that anything's wrong.
Yeah.
And it's the same goes with that sense, or that kind of a mentality, in a sense, filters out through first responders, through firemen, through police officers, in a sense. A lot of people aren't getting help. But when you speak with people who've gone through that and are able to advocate for others, it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned something about screening and telephone calls. So that almost sounds like a social work function. What's the context there for these phone calls where you're doing this early screening?
Sure. So people have to call us to basically, we have to determine whether or not they're appropriate for our program. And so phone screens are one of the ways that we are able to do that. So with this clinical high-risk category that we serve, the clinic is actually funded specifically and solely for that. It's a prevention program. So in other words, if someone has already had a psychotic episode, technically they can no longer be clinical high risk. They've already had a psychotic episode. Now this becomes very kind of fun. You know, this whole area is not black and white. It's very gray, as you know.
Yeah.
But that's the purpose of those phone screens, is to determine whether or not the person on the other end is appropriate to come in for an assessment.
Yeah. Now, where did you do your doctoral work?
I did my doctoral work at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, which has since become Sophia University.
Yes. Yeah, I know some of that history and have had contact with some of the founders and so on of that program. So it's interesting that coming out of the Transpersonal Institute, where I think in part they would have an inclination to look at psychosis as a spiritual emergency, was that part of the perspective that you were coming from or not?
That's there. Uh-huh. I mean, again, all of this is on a continuum. I mean, that's certainly there. But I think one of the great things that I took from that school is this ability to look at what we do from a holistic perspective, from a 360-degree perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea has really informed my own work in the podcast, for example. It's looking at trauma and treatment and healing, not just from EMDR, not just from CBT, for example, but from every which way.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you've founded something called the Trauma Therapist Project.
Exactly.
And so what is that now? What is it that you hope that it will become if it isn't fully realized yet?
Sure. The goal with that, well, if I may take a step back, when I was in graduate school and I knew that I wanted to get into this field of trauma, there was, despite the fact that I was kind of chomping at the bit to start working in the field, to start seeing clients, I was scared to actually do the work. Something freaked me out about, I mean, not something, it's the idea of sitting with a kid who's been sexually abused, you know, to state the worst case scenario in a sense, scared me. But at the same time, I was so compelled and drawn to want to help someone like that. I kind of felt in my gut that I knew I could do that. And that drove me to do that. In part, I talked about my experience commuting with those podcasts and then that phone call with that girl and then doing these phone screens. As I got into my different practica and pre-doc and post-doc, I found out that a lot of people actually didn't have experience working with trauma. It was like, okay, you deal with that, or someone else deals with that. And so I started taking courses with the Janina Fisher Center of Motor Psychotherapy, which became an amazing experience and a foundation for me. And that kind of gave me the impetus to help other or try to help other clinicians, therapists, get into this. I kind of used my own fear, inadequacy in a sense, to like create this thing, create a platform that would not only help others get into the field, but provide education, provide encouragement, provide support, pretty much everything that I had wanted when I was sitting there commuting, driving, you know?
Yeah. Well, good for you that you were in touch with both sides of that and that you're able to speak about it so much. I recently did an interview with Tony Rumenier, who was talking about the importance of practice, even after you're a therapist, doing deliberate practice.
I just listened to that episode, actually.
Yeah. And so you're kind of doing one of the things I really admired about him, which was his ability to admit that he didn't know everything, that he had room to go to grow, and to seek out, you know, more so that he could get better and better. And I'm hearing that same sort of drive in you.
Well, again, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. when I, this is, you're going to get me admitting all these embarrassing things about myself, but it, they've become learning experiences for me. When I was in graduate school, you know, I had been in therapy. I was 36, and the majority of people there were younger.
Right.
And I thought to myself that I kind of had, although I appreciated and respected personal development, I kind of thought I kind of did that already. You know, my attitude was like, I kind of did that already. I wanted to like know what book I needed to read. What was a trauma book I needed to read? What workshop did I need to go to or conference that I need to attend that would launch me on this path? But after interviewing the people that I have, the number of people that I have, I realized that I was off. There was so much about kind of developing or cultivating authenticity or presence or vulnerability that I really didn't know. I didn't appreciate. And after hearing the guests that I've had on my show openly talk about their experiences and their quote unquote mistakes and what they've learned from them, I realized that, my needle was over here, and it needled, like my true north in a sense needed to come back. Uh-huh. That was such, and continues to be, an amazing learning experience for me. How integral that part is to this work, not only trauma therapists do, that we all do as mental health workers.
Yeah. So what are you doing have you done to bring that needle back?
It's a matter of self-awareness. It's a matter of, for example, before I see my clients, kind of centering, not rushing into sessions. It's, for example, that's one example. Another example is deep breathe, kind of meditating or deep breathing before my sessions, after my sessions, making sure I consult with my colleagues. So bringing that awareness into my work and literally kind of manifesting that. So it's taking deliberate actions, to use that word, and incorporating those things into the work that I do. Whereas before, maybe they were more kind of intellectualizations. Like, that's important. Uh-huh. But I kind of left it in the book, in a sense.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that makes sense. But.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. So back to the institute. It's not an institute, the trauma therapist project.
Yeah.
What is the project? Beyond the project of working on yourself?
Well, the project really is, again, kind of an umbrella organization that provides education, support, and community. Under that, you know, I have the podcast. Under that, I have my membership site, Trauma Therapist 2.0, which differs, in a sense, from the podcast. And, you know, we talk about that if you'd like. But the idea of this project is to create an overarching or umbrella company organization that has different factions that will help new clinicians begin their trauma-informed journey.
Mm-hmm.
For example, providing live events, creating live events is something that I want to do. And I'm really fascinated with what we're doing now and thinking about the dearth of trauma education currently. Of course, now it's slowly beginning to appear in blips, but I think collectively there still is this dearth of information and education for a lot of people. How can, what small part can I play in bringing that to a wider audience?
Okay. Yeah, you know, you were 36, your co-students were a lot younger, I guess, for the most part. And it raises the question in my mind is, it's one about, are people coming into the field maybe too young, too inexperienced, getting certified without really having sufficient grounding? It sounds like that's something you want to address.
As far as being trauma informed, definitely. And I think, again, having the experience of going to a pre-practicum, a practicum, a pre-doc and a post-doc where you're spending years in these particular facilities and seeing many, many different clinicians having the smallest amount of trauma education. And that's no fault of their own to a certain extent, but that's, you know, institutions aren't providing that. And that brings up the question of how society, right, looks at trauma and experiences trauma. And it's interesting, you're kind of going back to these phone screens, trauma is almost like a box that's checked. A lot of clinicians, for example, when they're asking about trauma or assessing for trauma, it's just that word. You know, have you experienced any trauma? Many people don't even know what that is. And a lot of people associate that with being a veteran and having, you know, PTSD or explosives and so forth. But people, a lot of people don't understand the gradations, the continuum of trauma, whether it be sexual abuse or bullying, for example. I myself was a victim of that, and you know, witnessing violence and so forth. So,
yeah, in a way that's surprising to hear, because it, in a way, it seems like we're in a trauma saturated society now, where it's often part of the conversation, and there are critics who've kind of seemed to have said that, hey, we're getting overly sensitive, that everything's being defined as a trauma, that a professor has to be careful what they say in class because they may use a trigger, something like that. So in a way, it's surprising to hear you saying that we're in some ways undereducated about trauma and in this context that I've just laid out.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, and my response would be that it's not a cookie cutter example. I mean, one thing, one experience might be traumatic for me, but not might not be traumatic for you. And I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, that person was bullied, that didn't impact them. Well, that person, that bullying for that period of time might impact the trajectory of that person's life. I mean, I see it all the time, and I know it's happened for me. But I think one of the important things to understand is it's how that person interprets that experience. And trigger, I mean, again, you're exactly right to use that word. Some people take, you know, as an example, person over here, maybe they grew up in an extremely stressful environment in which they witnessed domestic violence or heard domestic violence in the other room. And something that they encounter in different contexts could very well trigger them and impact them in a particular way. Whereas that person who's witnessing that or seeing that, or that teacher in that example, wouldn't even understand that, wouldn't even know that.
Yeah.
So
Let's move on a bit to your podcast. How many interviews have you done at this point?
I've done 220.
That's a lot. And in what period of time? How often are you doing these?
Well, initially, I started out publishing two a week.
Wow, and then, that's a lot.
Yeah, and then I needed a hip replacement. And so I went down to once a week at that time. And that's been a godsend. It's really helped me just managing, you know, practically managing. But I love doing it. I love talking to people like yourself, and I just find it so inspiring.
Yeah. Well, I'm finding one a week to be a stiff pace. So two a week, I think, would be really, quite a bit.
It was kind of crazy. I mean, I'm married, I've got two kids, I'm working a full-time job, and it was definitely tipping the scale in the red zone, if you will.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you're learning or that you have learned as a result of all these interviews that you've been doing?
I think one of the primary things that I've learned is not only does it take becoming trauma-informed, but there's this other component, again, that I missed out on, is this ability, and I think a lot of people underestimate the importance of being able, not only connecting with the client, but being able to connect with your client, develop a rapport with your client, develop a relationship with your client, being authentic. What does that mean? We use that word so freely, but truly being present, and how to cultivate that. The people I speak with are, the common thread, common denominator, if you will, is trauma. They work at it from a variety of angles, variety of experiences or modalities. And they all share, for the most part, this understanding of the importance of being authentic with their clients. And they've learned that because there's almost always been some mishap or mistake or error, if you will, that they learned from. And that is a crucial piece. And in a sense, it's really one of the things that I love talking about and I really want to highlight in the work I do. So that's one of the major pieces.
Who is your podcast for? Who's your ideal listener that you had in mind when you created it?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's someone who is maybe in school, maybe they're a therapist with some years of experience, and they want to start learning about trauma, but don't know where to begin. That's my ideal person. And when I get emails from that person and they're like, oh my gosh, thank you for, and I'm sure you get those emails too. It's exciting. I mean, it's learning from kind of, again, the mistakes that I've made. And there are plenty of people out there who are like, how the heck do I start? Do I read this book? Do I read that book? What course should I take and why? What modality should I choose and why? And being able to provide a window into this other facet, which is kind of the inner work. I like to call it the inner work. I love doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a term that you've used several times is trauma-informed. What is a trauma-informed person?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the catchword in a sense right now in terms of trauma-informed defines a trauma-sensitive intervention specifically. Someone who's trauma-informed, hopefully, ideally, is educated in best practices of providing care for someone who's been traumatized, for someone who's maybe has complex trauma or PTSD. That's what that would mean.
To what extent are you finding that people who go into this trauma work are coming at it from a history of trauma themselves?
Yeah, another good question. A large part. Uh-huh. And again, it's on a continuum too.
Sure.
Most of the people that I've talked to have had varying degrees of experience with trauma. I think maybe one or two I can think of who haven't. And it's funny because when I started this, I didn't think of myself as someone who really experienced trauma. And it wasn't until kind of things began to unfold a little bit with the podcast that I realized that the experience I had when I was bullied kind of fixed a template of how I related to people, of how I related to myself, mm-hmm. and realized that, yeah, I was traumatized. So I have a strong, I think, appreciation and understanding for this whole, for people who've been bullied, especially.
Yeah. Have you been tempted at all to carry your work into schools to do presentations on bullying or to move in that direction?
I've thought about it kind of on the periphery. I honestly don't know if I'm ready to start getting out into schools like that. I'd love to maybe create something that's online. I know there's a podcast out. I think it's called The Grass Gets Greener, and she specializes in bullying. Actually, it's a pretty cool podcast. But
Yeah, I think that's a really important topic and one that, fortunately, I have four kids, three of whom were sons. I don't think they got bullied. I'm not aware of it. I don't think they got bullied. But as had they been in that situation as a parent, I would have felt kind of paralyzed, I think.
I think a lot of people, again, underestimate the severity of bullying. And again, like you said, don't know what to do. I will say that a lot of the people, a lot of the parents that we encounter in the clinic that I work in aren't aware that their kids have been bullied. And a lot of kids, they don't tell their parents. Mm-hmm. I was assessing with a colleague of mine, this young kid who we had in the office with his parents. And there, at that moment, for the first time, he shared with his parents that he'd been bullied like a year ago for, 6 or 7 months straight, just kind of merciless stuff. And he didn't want to share it with his parents because of the classic reasons, right? People will retaliate. People are not going to do anything. Other kids are going to find out. So,
well, this whole internet era has really escalated those kinds of fears. I mean, it's now so much more public than it used to be. And a kid can be widely humiliated, which we know has led to suicide in some cases.
It's true. I mean, and when you're talking about a situation where people are killing themselves, you've got to start taking some precautions. I mean, it's not, he'll get over it or she'll get over it or... and again, I want to recognize that, not everything is bullying, right? Some things are just kids messing around. But when you're talking about bullying, when there is that power dynamic, when certain things start to happen, we have to take it seriously. So I think there are certain organizations, and again, the podcast, like I mentioned, people are starting to look at it and take it seriously. So
what does it take to do this kind of work of trauma therapy? What's your advice to people maybe that are like you at one point who wanted to get into the field? What's your advice to people that are thinking of moving in this direction?
Yeah, I would say to move forward, go forward. I would say go for it, basically, and to do it in a way that feels good in your gut. I mean, obviously, as someone who's going to specialize or even get trauma informed, you have to be educated. You have to do your due diligence and read, take classes, take courses, whatever. But the flip side to that, and I think this is what I would advise, is to honor your own development, to pay heed to the importance of what it means to practice self-nourishment. As one of my guests called self-care, which I love, self-nourishment. The importance of that, I think, is lost on a lot of us. To understand the value, especially the value of someone who's been traumatized, of being able to formulate a relationship. I think a lot of times, from my own experience in working with particular colleagues, there's people who've been traumatized, clients who've been traumatized, it almost feels like they're a hot potato, because we don't know what to do with it. We don't know how to respond. There's a fear of, am I going to say the wrong thing? And I don't know what to say. I might re-trigger them. I might re-traumatize them. And this comes back again to the power of being able to be in that relationship with someone. That provides us the grounding of the relationship, and the client able to see that in us as a therapist. If we're able to not only get educated with books and workshops, et cetera, but to get educated in this other inner work sense, that becomes very powerful. So I would encourage people who are interested in doing this work to honor both sides. And I realize I'm kind of creating two sides of a coin, and I don't mean to be that limiting, but I just want to paint that picture in a sense.
Yeah, I had planned to ask you what qualities a person should have, but I think you're speaking to that, saying that they really need to be oriented towards being self-reflective and doing some inner work.
Definitely. And I remember one of my guests saying that they had a client once who was a young girl, and this particular guest going into this meeting had gotten a chart from someone, I forget the specifics of it, but he knew that this girl had been traumatized, I think it was sexual abuse. And, you know, he said to himself, well, I'm not really going to push the issue. I'm going to let this person open up when and if they want. And he said they never really did. And he later found out that this little girl knew that he was scared. You know, the clients know. They're able to feel and see what we're able to handle in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I think for us as clinicians, it's for me, one of the other learning experiences, I thought it was going to be easier in a sense. I thought that, again, you know, I had done that inner work. I had gone to therapy and got a lot out of it. And I kind of thought that was sufficient. But what I realized was that there was another step that I needed to take as a clinician. And I think it's really important to see that, to open that up.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about trauma as if it's one unitary thing, but then I guess there are all kinds of trauma or sources of trauma, right? There's sort of that which comes from war. There's that which comes from bullying. There's that which comes from being sexually abused. There's that which comes from having been in a horrible, disfiguring accident and on having some horrible disease, et cetera. So I'm thinking about that on the one hand, and on the other, I'm thinking there are all these different theoretical approaches and recommended interventions and so on. How does one make sense of all of that?
You're really giving me these easy questions, huh? How does one make sense of that in terms of what?
Well, theoretically, I guess I'm wondering there are different models out there. You mentioned CBT, you mentioned EMDR, eye movement desensitization, reprocessing. There's van der Kolk's work, there are other big name people. Sure. You mentioned the sensory awareness approach. Where do you see this field going theoretically? Will we have a plethora of different approaches, or do you see it all coming together?
I think that's a really good question. And in interviewing the wide variety of people that I have, it seems like what's happening is a greater and greater understanding of the neurobiology of trauma is coming out. And that means that, or what's happening from that, is that many kind of fingers and tributaries of treatment are emerging. It's not as if EMDR, though it's been shown to be very effective, can treat or will treat every type of trauma or every person. So I think that for practitioners who are going to this field, we have to have the understanding, or it would be very useful to have the understanding that, you know, just because one size fits all is not the order of the day here. It's being familiar, not necessarily being a specialist, but being familiar with many different types of modalities, in a sense, because whoever comes into your office, that they're not going to, you know, fit into the nice little box that we have in our minds of how we can treat someone. And it was, you know, Janina Fisher. I was in a consultation group with Janina Fisher, and she said something to me that I'll never forget. And it was this: it's that, you know, our job is not to kind of impose an intervention on a particular client. You know, even though, you know, when I read, you know, Bessel van der Kolk's book, and on page 42, there's something that really inspires me, and I know that I can, you know, implement this particular intervention. It's rather to be aware, to hear when our client kind of opens the door and almost asks for a particular intervention. Are we aware enough, educated enough, in a sense, to be able to step into that and meet them where they are at that time? That takes an enormous amount of, you know, almost everything we've been talking about has, it takes an enormous amount. It's not easy. And I think that's what, from my perspective, really differentiates these people. I mean, not unlike yourself, who've had years of experience. That experience is so invaluable, I think. But to kind of get back to your question about some advice, I think it's being aware that there are many different types of modalities out there for really good reasons. Mm-hmm. And that is, there are many different types of people and many different types of trauma. So
yeah, so one of the things I'm hearing from you is that it's a continual learning process, and that the sincere practitioner really is signing up for a lifetime of continuing education.
I mean, perfectly succinctly said. And it's, again, it's being able to leave our kind of agenda at the door, you know, leave our suitcase of amazing interventions, trauma interventions, you know, that I learned last week at my workshop at the door to a certain extent, right? Yeah. Not bring in that blueprint that, okay, this person said that, you know, this stuff. So.
Right. Yeah. 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 And so I wonder if there's anything that we have not touched on here that you were really hoping to get into the conversation.
I think one thing that I if I can mention, my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0, which is actually specifically designed, you know, you talked about people just getting into the field. I mean, that's what it's for. You know, I created this community to help people get into this field. You know, whereas on the podcast, I really focus on exploring the journey of my guests, actually, how they got into this field, what inspired them. And in Trauma Therapist 2.0, which I do video interviews, I really kind of drill down and ask my guests to talk specifically about how they work with their clients. So it's much more instructional for the members of the community. So we have a private Facebook group as well. It's about going on this journey with other people who are passionate about this work. So again, that's what I'm hoping to create, and it's been going well so far. So thanks for allowing me to mention that. I appreciate that.
Well, how can people find these various aspects of your work?
Yeah, just definitely traumatherapistproject.com. It's that simple.
Okay.
That's my website. They can access the podcast there. They can access Trauma Therapist 2.0, which is the membership there. And even, you know, get in touch with me there, traumatherapistproject.com.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, Guy, I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and it's been educational for me. I'm thinking back to the beginning and about that early onset psychosis, which I hope to learn more about as time goes on. So I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dr. Dave, it was awesome. Again, it was an honor being on here, and I admire everything that you've done and how much you've created and contributed to the community. It's inspiring for me. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm hoping you couldn't tell during the interview that I woke up this morning with a bad cold. I was really worried I would start sneezing or coughing or dripping on the microphone. Fortunately, none of that happened, although I wouldn't be surprised if you heard me unconsciously sniff every now and then. Fortunately, my guest, Dr. Guy McPherson, brought abundant energy to the interview, and that kept me focused and pulled me out of my funk. I loved his humility in speaking about the lack of confidence that he started out with in his trauma work. And, of course, I particularly admire that not only was he honest with himself about that, but also about the way that he set out to enhance his competence and his confidence. As a podcaster, of course, I'm interested that he turned to podcasting as one of the tools for learning and developing that needed expertise and confidence. Those were not driving factors in my own decision to take up podcasting, but they did turn out to be happy byproducts of doing so. As you heard, my ears really picked up in the beginning when he was speaking about his current job doing early intervention with adolescent psychosis. I should have asked him for some names of the people who are the movers and shakers in that movement. I think that's a topic that would be a good one to explore in more depth on the show. It's clear that Dr. McPherson is building his livelihood around being a resource for people entering the field of trauma therapy. I think he's got a great start on that, and I wish him future success. You can find out more about Dr. McPherson's various offerings, including his podcast, by going to thetraumatherapistproject.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Paul Fishman. I practice psychiatry in San Francisco, and I've been a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts on my phone for over a year. I'm finally getting around to sending you a donation. I've hesitated to go to your website to find the donation link because I wanted to do so along with sending you kudos in the form of a particular reflection on one of your podcasts, hoping I'd thereby encourage others to donate. I might have done so on several inspiring occasions over the past year, but I haven't had the time. I want to encourage other listeners not to do as I have done. Go to the website now and click the donate link. Your reflections are not required to make a donation.
Thank you, psychiatrist Dr. Paul Fishman, for your donations and encouragement to others to help support Shrink Wrap Radio. Unfortunately, there are no new donors to announce. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Dr. Paul Fishman's call to action? The fact that professionals of his caliber are so enthusiastic about Shrink Wrap Radio should bring home to you the value of the show and the merits of becoming a supporter. Let me remind you again to use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar. You can use it to buy not only books, but anything under the sun that Amazon sells. That way, we get a small percentage, and it's just another way that you can help to support the show. And it's been a while since I've mentioned our Shrink Wrap Radio app. It allows you to stream or download Shrink Wrap episodes on your smartphone, whether it be an iPhone or Android phone. It also gives you access to almost 400 of the most recent episodes. Amazing! All this content in your pocket or purse. Go to the Apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full details. Finally, let me wrap up this segment of the show by reminding you to go to our website and look at the list of books by some of our past guests. You can click on the book covers there in the right-hand sidebar to order directly from Amazon.com. Let's reward these guests for choosing to advertise on our website. The most recent edition is Alexandra Katahakis's book, Sex Addiction as Affect Dysregulation. This one is definitely destined to be a classic.
Hi, this is Dr. Guy McPherson, Oakland, California psychologist, founder of the Trauma Therapist Project, and host of the Trauma Therapist Podcast. And you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Well, thank you, Dr. Guy McPherson, whom we just heard from. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. Attention, all Persian speakers. Wherever in the world you might be, once again, we hear from Mayar in Iran, who writes, to extend an invitation to other speakers of the Persian language, Farsi. And Mayar writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, it's been some time since I wanted to ask to see if you are aware of other listeners in Iran. Are there other people who've approached you in these years from Tehran or other cities? The thing is, and it might just be my wishful thinking, that if there are other Iranian listeners who might be in the field of mental health, we could establish connections and share ideas, opportunities, or maybe set journal clubs to read books and papers and do some transcripts for Persian listeners. You know that besides Iran, there are Persian speakers in Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and even in India. So do you know of listeners in other countries who have gathered together like this? Would you recommend it at all?" He goes on to say, "You remember Professor Vanier, the French analyst whom I invited for a lecture at our university? I have requested a visa for him in May of 2017, and this year I've sent requests to other universities as well, and we're going to Shiraz University as well, and I was wondering, why not find other Iranian shrink wrap radio listeners and see what we could do to help the community of Iranians who've been shrink wrapped? I was just thinking there might be other residents of Iran or Persian speakers who simply have not stepped forward to write to you, just like myself, who wrote for the first time after some 3 years of being an existing listener. I'm just enjoying the image of us Iranians, shrink wrap radio listeners, engaging in a shared project or whatever. That sounds wonderful, no? Many thanks for your support. Hugs," and that's from Mayar. And of course, I do think that would be wonderful. So if you are a speaker of Farsi and you'd like to get in touch with Mayar, just send me an email, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and I will pass your information along to Mayar. In this time of the United States being fairly closed to Iran and vice versa, I think it's good to open up whatever doors and windows of communication we possibly can. So with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our Shrink Wrap Radio app that I mentioned earlier, or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Guy McPherson, for sharing his work in trauma and early psychosis therapy. My guest for next week will be attorney and life coach Mark Susnow, who is the author of the inspirational book, The Soul of Uncertainty, A Fable for Our Times. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.